I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. He's pioneered the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery, which has led to the development of over 30 companies. He is a father of three children and a magician. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your influence on the biomaterials field is vast, and I'd like to start with the early days of your professional life because, in a way, it helped to inform what you are doing today. After graduating from Cornell, you were a graduate student at MIT, and this was during the 1970s, during the energy crisis. How did the energy crisis indirectly lead you to the field of scientific discovery?
Sure. There was this gas shortage, you know, all over the country, and the gas shortage in Boston was really bad. So there were all kinds of jobs in the petrochemical oil industry for chemical engineers. They were hiring like crazy. Pretty much my colleagues, my friends, that's what they did. They got jobs in the oil industry, and so I thought that's what I should do too. So I went to a lot of interviews, and I got about 20 job offers from different oil companies, actually four from Exxon alone. But I remember one of them in particular, one of the engineers said to me, you know, if you could just increase the yield of this one chemical by like 0.1%, he said, that would be wonderful. It'd be worth billions of dollars. And I remember flying home to Boston that night thinking to myself, I just don't want to do that. It just seemed to me, you know, that I could, there were things that I could do with my life that I thought maybe could help people and would be more important, at least to me. So I started looking for other ideas about what I could do.
Now, you sent some ideas for a chemistry curriculum to various education institutions. How were they received?
One of the things I did when I was a graduate student at MIT is I helped start a school for poor kids and high school, and I got involved in creating new chemistry curricula. And so I remember writing letters, answering different ads to different colleges to be an assistant professor that would be developing new chemistry curriculum. But none of them wrote me back. So the next thing I thought about, since I wasn't doing so well finding good jobs or finding any jobs where I could do chemistry education, I thought about medicine. So I wrote a lot of hospitals and medical schools, and they didn't write me back either. But one day, one of the people in the lab where I was at said to me, Bob, there's this surgeon in Boston named Judah Folkman. And he said, sometimes he hires unusual people. He thought very highly of Dr. Folkman. I won't say what he thought about me. But I wrote to Dr. Folkman, and he was kind enough to offer me a job.
And it was your research with Dr. Folkman that had a seminal impact on what you're doing today to some degree. What was it specifically that you were working on?
So Dr. Folkman had a theory that if you could stop blood vessels from growing in the body, that might be a new way to stop cancer someday, a new way to treat cancer someday. But it was a theory, and actually a lot of people didn't agree with that theory. And what he asked me to do was to see if I could isolate what would become the first inhibitor of angiogenesis, the first inhibitor of blood vessel growth. So that's how I got started.
If you could stop the growth of blood vessels, you could stop the growth of tumors developing further. Is that correct?
Yeah. The thinking was is that tumors without blood vessels will not go beyond a very tiny size of about 1 mm³. But if the tumor is permeated by blood vessels, then that solves the nutrition problem for them, and they can get much bigger. And then, of course, they can also metastasize or spread through those same blood vessels and set up shop in other parts of the body.
You used an eye of a rabbit to help with your research. What is special about the eye of a rabbit?
Yeah, well, it's big, so it's easy to visualize. So what we thought about was if we could have a plastic, a slow-release polymer, that could take anything that was in cartilage, that's what we were studying, and A, not cause harm to the eye, and B, deliver those molecules for a couple months or more, that might be a way to study how blood vessels would grow or not grow.
You mentioned polymers. These are plastics, essentially.
The polymers we use would be plastics. Polymers could also be rubber and so forth. Polymer is basically a long chain substance.
We're talking about manufactured tissues, polymers. What was the landscape of biomaterials when you were pioneering this field in the 1970s?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Most biomaterials that people used in the body were largely driven by medical doctors, clinicians. And what they do is they would often go to their house and find an object that would kind of resemble the organ or tissue they wanted to fix. So just to give a few examples, the material in the artificial heart, that was a lady's girdle material because it had a good, you know, good buoyancy or flex life. And the material in a breast implant, that was actually, one of them was actually a mattress stuffing because it was the right squishiness. The material in a what's called a vascular graft, an artificial blood vessel, that was a surgeon going to a clothes store and finding something they could sew well with. And so almost all of the biomaterials in the 70s had origins like that. They were sort of what I'd call off-the-shelf materials. And that may solve some problems, but it also created problems because they weren't optimally designed for the body. For example, if you take the artificial heart, the lady's girdle material, you put it in the body and sometimes the blood hits the surface of that and it forms a clot. Mm. And that clot could go to the patient's brain and they'd get a stroke and they die. And obviously there's been problems with different breast implant materials and other things as well.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer, who is the chief researcher and founder of the Langer Labs at MIT. He's considered a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. In the 1980s, you founded the Langer Lab at MIT. What was the purpose for this lab?
My goals were to do things that I thought might someday help and improve people's lives by doing things at the interface of chemical engineering and medicine.
How was it received when you went to the administration at MIT and said, you know, I'd like to form this lab just to facilitate this research that I'm doing?
Yeah, well, certainly my early years of doing the research, you know, a number of my senior colleagues didn't think it was very important or didn't think it was very good, and they suggested that I probably should start looking for new jobs.
Why was it? Because your field was so nascent, there weren't a lot of... Why was that?
I think that people's idea of what's important probably has a lot to do with what they're doing themselves. And, you know, and they had different areas in this department, but this didn't fit into any of those. And I think the thinking was if I didn't fit into something that pre-existed, I probably wouldn't get promoted. I probably wouldn't get tenure.
Since your research wasn't well received at MIT, did you ever think of maybe moving to an environment that was more friendly to the type of work you were doing?
Well, I actually think MIT was as friendly as any place. You know, my first 9 grants were turned down, and nobody at MIT were on the sections that turned them down. In fact, MIT was you know, I still think is a great place to be. If you go against the prevailing scientific wisdom anywhere in the world, you're going to run into problems.
So how did you break through that conventional bias?
Well, I don't know if I really ever did. I just kept doing the work that I thought was important, and I started, you know, publishing it. And I think pharmaceutical companies started to notice it. And they said that they were nice enough to say that the work they thought was very important.
What were some examples of early breakthroughs that helped to lend credibility to what you were doing?
So we had published this paper in 1976 in Nature showing that you could deliver molecules of almost any size. So that was probably the breakthrough, or that was maybe the first breakthrough. But people thought trying to get these molecules, big molecules, through a plastic was kind of like you or I walking through a brick wall.
Even though the plastic was porous?
Well, people didn't know that then, and we didn't know that then either. So the challenge would be the following. You could either have something that would be non-porous that you couldn't get through at all, or anything that was porous would be kind of like Swiss cheese, so you could get through it, but then you'd get through it almost instantaneously. Mm. And what we were seeing was that we'd have these tiny little particles, and yet the drugs would come out for over 100 days. So the problem would be, how could that happen? And that just defied what I like to say, conventional wisdom.
We talk about your research gaining academic acceptance. What was the first example of the commercialization of one of your findings?
Well, there were a couple, but I think one of the early ones was we designed polymers that could dissolve in a certain special way, and what we call surface erosion, kind of like how bar soap dissolves. And what was done in this particular case is it delivers an anti-cancer drug. It's all done locally, so the cancer drug doesn't go throughout the whole body. It just is given locally to the tumor. And then there was a company originally Nova Pharmaceuticals and later Guilford Pharmaceuticals that licensed it and developed it, and ultimately it led to a product that's still used today, actually, in treating brain cancer called the Gliadel wafer.
This is one of the earliest examples of the commercialization of one of your discoveries. Since then, roughly 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed your discoveries. Were you surprised by this torrent of commercial applications for what you were doing?
Yeah, it's hard to say whether I was surprised or not. I wanted people to use it. You know, when you're in academia and you're a professor, I mean, you're training students, which I love to do, and you're making discoveries and findings, which is also what I like to do. But I also want to see what we do get used. I just don't want it to be a scientific paper that just, you know, people read about. I wanted to see what we did have an impact on people's lives. That's why I got involved in the patenting process, and that's why, you know, I wanted to see our things get licensed to companies and ultimately license, you know, create companies ourselves, because if we didn't do that, you know, I find if you're not your own champion, it's very hard to find others who are going to be.
Often there's controversy around tech transfer of universities or academics using their discoveries for commercial ends because it leads to potential conflicts of interest. What was that landscape like for you?
I think MIT, you know, along with Stanford, is probably the top two technology transfer places in the world. And I think their goal is really the same as mine. It's not actually to make money. It's not to – it's really how can we, you know, maximize the chances of products being developed.
MIT, which was founded in 1861, one of its missions was to provide and support industrialization of America. So MIT had more of a commercial slant to it than perhaps other academic institutions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think MIT wants to see products created. They want to see things get out to the public.
Incidentally, once a technology or an innovation is discovered and is profitable, it's split in three ways. A third of the profit goes to the department, a third goes to the university, and a third goes to the inventor.
As far as I know, that's the policy that MIT uses, and I think a lot of universities follow something close to that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Langer, a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. We'll hear more from Dr. Langer coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs, with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. Dr. Langer has helped to launch nearly 30 companies and holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed his lab's discoveries. We're talking about the profitability of some of these discoveries, and you turn to the private sector for the funding of some of these companies. Polaris is a venture capital company in Boston that has invested over $200 million in your companies, roughly 20 companies. How did that relationship start?
There was a company that I was starting with a woman named Sherry Oberg, and she was wanted to have a company that would create the new imaging agents, and we'd published a paper actually in Science that lended itself to doing that. She was a Dartmouth graduate in the business school. She knew a guy named Terry McGuire, and she introduced me to him, and it was probably early 90s, and she also asked if he was interested in investing in the company, which he did. So we've had a great relationship. I mean, like you said, they've probably done close to 20 companies that we've been involved in.
What are imaging agents? You said that you developed imaging.
Yeah. So in this case, let's say you were doing an ultrasound. And for certain things, you can use ultrasound and, you know, get a pretty good picture. But for example, if you wanted to see whether you had a heart defect or certain other kinds of vascular abnormality and you tried to use ultrasound, the contrast isn't good enough. So if you could create an ultrasound contrast agent that was good enough, then you could see things by ultrasound imaging that you wouldn't really be able to see otherwise. And you could certainly see it with much, much greater detail.
So, for instance, if you're pregnant and you go to get an ultrasound, are some of these imaging agents used in seeing the baby in the placenta?
So in the case of looking at a baby, you don't need to do that because I think the contrast is good enough. But if you wanted to look at if you wanted to look at something much smaller, let's say you wanted to look at I'll make this up, the baby's toe or something like that, and you wanted to zoom in on it, it might be very hard to see with a regular picture. The contrast agent might be useful for doing that. Mm-hmm. By the way, I think there are still hardly any ultrasound agents approved, mm-hmm. The ultrasound contrast agents approved. I expect there will be by this or others, but it's a long road to getting approval for anything.
You mentioned that these have not been approved yet, and a firm like Polaris has been very patient. It's patient capital, understanding that they might not see proceeds for decades.
That's right. I mean, though they've done very well, as far as I know from what I guess people in business called an IRR standpoint. I mean, I think people in the investment business understand that when you're doing medical work, you don't do it on the sales at the time, you do it on the promise of the company, and that's turned out to work. I mean, an early company that I was an advisor to for many, many years was Genentech, and that came out in the stock market and did fantastic, and they had no products, a lot of promise, but ultimately they did get products, and those products were blockbusters.
Let's talk about the entrepreneurial nature of what you've done. Sure. You're a pioneer in science. You are also a pioneer in tech transfer, in a way, in commercializing a lot of this research. What are some of the hurdles that you've faced entrepreneurially, even outside of, you know, the development of your lab in the early days in the 1980s?
Yeah, well, I think the challenges that you run into when you try to do entrepreneurial things, I mean, one is always raising money. But two is, again, some of your colleagues won't think highly of it. You know, Dr. Folkman actually said it very well once. He actually got one of the earliest industrial grants. He got about $23 million from Monsanto for his cancer research in the 1970s. And he was at a dinner and somebody asked him, what are the advantages and disadvantages of getting that kind of money? And he said, well, let me do the disadvantages first. He said there's a gene that a lot of people have that's not expressed directly. It's expressed indirectly. And he said that gene is called jealousy. And if you're a young faculty member, that's not such a good thing because people can control your future. You know, and then a third thing is anytime you try to create any entity, you're dealing with all kinds of people. I mean, with different personalities. I mean, that's good because they're going to – but somehow they have to come together to create this company. And you have to have good business people and good scientists and good clinical people. And sometimes there might be conflicts. And so you have to try to help on those things.
You've helped to launch close to 30 companies. It's not like you're being Jeff Bezos and you launched one company called Amazon. Here you have sprinkled dozens of companies around in your atmosphere. So how do you think about starting a company? Do you just say, well, here's a great idea and, hey, you CEO with this specific background, you go run with it and I'll advise? You're like a godfather to these companies more than in the trenches every day.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably fair. I mean, to me, my major mission still is being a professor and teaching and doing research at MIT and training students. But I also want, when we create something, for it to get out to the public. And my students and postdocs, some of them will go into academic positions, some of them want to take their inventions and make a company out of it. And so so if we're fortunate enough to, A, have made an important discovery, and, B, have somebody who wants to run with it, you know, I want to help them do that.
Incidentally, some of the applications for your research have been in fields other than medicine. One example is in the waste industry. Can you describe that?
Well, actually, one of the things that one of our postdocs, Avi Dohm, created was a polymer, but that would help in what's called flocculation.
And what
that means is if, like, you have a swimming pool and you have waste or junk in the swimming pool, you know, it could be leaves or it could be, you know, dirt, anything. A flocculant is something that makes those things come together. So rather than it be over your entire pool, over your entire surface, it comes together and it's very easy to then remove. And so there's something that company license called Superflock that was very, very widely used.
What are some other tangible technologies that have come out of your lab that we might know of?
Well, we've created fat substitutes that people have used for foods.
What's an example? Like, well, what product?
Like, for example, Hood no-fat sour cream or yogurts. Those use these products. Hmm. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things like that. There's a company we've started called Living Proof, which is in the hair care industry. And also Jennifer Aniston is involved in that as well.
As an investor.
Yes. And so there's products that the company and my students and postdocs and everybody we've and people at the company have created that can prevent frizzy hair, that can give hair more body. And of course, all the medical ones, some of the companies that we've been involved in, I mean, they've created products that can help people with schizophrenia, help people with alcoholism, help people with diabetes.
What's an example of an application of your discovery to treatment of alcoholism?
So the very first company that I got involved starting was a company called Enzatec. And what we did was make little this came out from our early discoveries that we could make microspheres that could release molecules of any size. We merged that company with our downstairs neighbor, Alchemies. And basically that company has created a microsphere that can deliver a drug for a month. It's been shown to greatly reduce alcoholism.
So a microsphere being a polymer that releases a chemical that inhibits the desire to drink alcohol?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a little microsphere that you can inject through a small needle once a month. And does just what you said. You can also use that same microsphere to, reduce people's reliance on cocaine or narcotics as well.
We've talked a lot about polymers and controlled drug delivery to things like tumors. You've also spent a good portion of your career on tissue engineering, tissue regeneration. Can you describe what that is briefly?
Sure. Well, lots of times people have serious medical problems where they don't have, their liver's gone bad or they're burned or all kinds of problems where they don't have a tissue or an organ or it's been seriously damaged. So around 1983, a friend of mine, Jay Vacanti, he's head of pediatric surgery at Mass General, he came to talk to me about this. At that time, he was head of the liver transplant program at Children's Hospital. And we started talking about ways that we might be able to use plastics and cells, mammalian cells, to craft new tissues and organs. And that would eventually lead to new strategies for creating artificial skin for burn victims, new ways of creating, livers or, intestines. A lot of them are at the research stage. We're also looking at ways of making new spinal cords for people that are paralyzed, vocal cords for people that have difficulty speaking or singing. So all kinds of things like that.
So what is the tissue made of?
Well, the strategy that we use is you have a polymer plastic scaffold, and then you put the cells on it. And over time, the cells make what's called their own extracellular matrix. So all the same proteins, hopefully, and sugars and other things that are in the human body, to begin with, the cells recreate. Hmm. And over time, that plastic scaffold dissolves. It's a dissolvable scaffold that we've designed. So in essence, rather than ladies' girdles or other things, what you're having is what the body normally would have, which are what are called these extracellular matrix proteins and polysaccharides.
So the plastic delivers, it's sort of a platter for this artificial tissue, which flirts with or fraternizes with the real tissue in the body, and they cohere and intermingle and then become their own organism.
Yeah, I think that you said it pretty well.
Hmm.
Yeah. Each tissue has its own challenges, but that's sort of the general strategy that we've developed.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder and chief researcher of the Langer Labs at MIT. Dr. Langer holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed the discoveries originated in his labs. Dr. Langer is a magician. I'd like to turn to your personal life.
Sure.
Tell me about this magic.
Well, I've always been fascinated by magic. So from time to time, I try to learn how to do tricks. I mean, I remember taking even a magic class, and, you know, I would always love going to magic shops and seeing people do tricks. And I used to do shows when my kids were little. And I remember one time even doing a show at MIT for 400 people. That was a while ago. I'm probably pretty rusty now.
Is there an area of magic that you prefer? Do you like the cards or the body disappearance or what?
Yeah, well, actually, I like the cards. People have often broken up magic into two kinds of magic, stage magic and close-up magic. Stage magic is like the body disappearing and things like that. But I've always liked the sort of close-up magic with cards or coins, but particularly cards. I've always thought those were fascinating.
In a way, magic and chemistry or science seem on the face of it very similar. You have something that, you know, on the surface is wow-generating. And your job and your hobby is to understand how to create that wow. Your job is to understand the reasons for that outcome.
I mean, some things could even, you know, appear like magic. Like, we just published a paper a week or two ago in Science where some of my postdocs found like this plastic or polymer that can, you put it on your hand and it starts jumping all over the place. And it can even lift things. That's almost magical. And a lot of what we've ended up doing in the lab is understanding better phenomena that is extremely complicated.
How long have you been interested in magic?
Oh, I've been, you know, many, many years since I was a little boy.
You grew up in Albany, New York. What did your parents do?
Well, my dad ran a small liquor store, and my mom was a homemaker. Took care of me and my sister.
What was your home life like?
It was great. I mean, you know, we lived on a small street in Albany. You know, I had a lot of friends. Remember playing baseball and football and things like that. And I went to the local public school, 27. It was nice.
You're an inventor, essentially. At what point did you think, you know, I'd like to be an inventor or some type of creator or engineer in your childhood? Were those seeds apparent to you that early?
They weren't apparent to me that early, but one of the things that I had that I got as gifts, there was a company called Gilbert when I was a little boy, and they made all kinds of great things that kids like to play with. I mean, they had this Erector set, and they had a whole bunch of different ones of various complexity, you know, where you could build structures like a merry-go-round, another where there was like a parachute jump, another where you could launch rockets. And then they also had a microscope set, and they had a chemistry set. And so I really enjoyed that kind of stuff when I was a little boy. And I even like with the chemistry set, I remember mixing different chemicals together and watching the solutions change color, which is magic. But also, it was a chemical reaction going on that caused that. But I never thought about inventing it. I just thought it was fun.
Would you say that you fell into what you're doing accidentally, or was it more mindful?
Well, I think it's somewhat accidental. I mean, you know, I certainly had no grand plan ever. I think the big thing that changed it for me in terms of what I ended up doing was what my postdoctoral work after I graduated from MIT, when I went to work for Judah Folkman. And I was like probably one of the few chemical engineers in the world, maybe the only one, working in a surgery lab. And I started thinking about applying chemical engineering to medicine. And that certainly changed my life.
Dr. Folkman compared research to driving at night. Can you describe that analogy?
Yes, that's very good. Dr. Folkman said, you know, trying to solve the problem of angiogenesis or some of the other things would be kind of like driving at night. You can't see past where the headlights go, but you can do the whole trip that way. So in other words, you don't know the answer when you're starting, but you could make steps, and those steps would eventually get you there.
What are some images that come to your mind when you think of your research? You know, when is this driving at night? What about like crystallization? You know, how you have a formation of a crystal and it becomes like this whole network of crystals.
Right, right.
But that's my own.
Rock candy. That's significant. I mean, that's an example. I mean, certainly one thing that actually we were involved in. In fact, we started a company on that too, was a company called Transform, where one of the challenges actually when you make pharmaceuticals is having a good shelf life. Because you don't want to use a drug if the drug after you make it is unstable after a month, nobody's going to use it. You're going to ship it all over the world. You need it, and a lot of times you won't use a drug for a year or two. So getting the drug in the right crystal form, that's in the right stability, that actually is a big deal. If you don't get it in the right crystal form, it may not be stable, and then it won't be useful to anybody.
Hmm.
But if it is in the right crystal form, it can be very stable.
You exercise daily. How long have you been exercising, and why is it so important to you?
Well, I've probably been exercising probably for a lot, probably the last 32 years, 33 years. It's important. Well, my dad died of a heart attack when he was 61, and, you know, I was 28 at the time. I mean, I just you know, want to live as long as I can for my kids and my wife and my family. And
what kind of exercise? What do you do for exercise?
Well, I use a recumbent bike, elliptical machine, treadmill, and weights.
For how long?
Probably 2 to 3 hours a day.
So 2 to 3 hours, that seems above average.
I think it's probably quite a bit above average, certainly for somebody my age. But I'm able to work while I do it, and my wife and kids actually exercise a lot. And, you know, we have this gym at home, so sometimes we're all doing it together, or at least a few of us. And so, it is certainly above average.
Hmm. You mentioned your wife. You met your wife at MIT. She's a neuroscientist. How did you meet?
We met on the track. I was running actually outside, and so was she. I knew her, though, a little bit because one of the people in our lab was roommates with her, so I knew her a little bit. But then I saw her on the track, and we started talking, and so that's how that happened.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
My guest has been the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer. Coming up, we'll meet Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes through the New York metro region, Long Island, and Los Angeles. Elizabeth and Julie opened their first studio in 2006 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the company has grown rapidly in popularity, attracting clients like Chelsea Clinton, Conan O'Brien, Katie Couric, and Kelly Ripa. SoulCycle classes are 45 minutes long and claim to be a full-body workout. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. For having us.
So you are both unlikely people to start an exercise company. Tell me a little bit about your background. Why don't we start with you, Elizabeth?
I grew up in Chicago. I was not one of those kids who was really into sports. And I lived in Colorado for 14 years. And when I was living in Colorado, I got into hiking in particular, which is a great form of cardio. And when I moved back to New York, I met my husband, and I did yoga also. And so I continued to do that. And after our children were born, I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And my mother, who I adore, told me, oh, you know, don't worry about what you eat. I wore my jeans home from the hospital. And sadly enough, that was not my experience whatsoever. And about 6 weeks after our first daughter was born, I still had 45 pounds to go. And one of my dearest friends just said to me, you have got to get some cardio. And I was so intimidated. I was afraid. And I went to take a class. And a light really went off for me. I really felt like if I could access this, then so many people who feel like they can't do cardio could access this, and it could really change something for them, because everybody needs cardio and most people hate it.
Now, this was an indoor cycling class. Can you explain what a spin class or an indoor cycling class is for those who have never taken one?
At SoulCycle, we ride on indoor cycling bikes, and we have pedals that people use specific bike shoes to clip into. And what's great about that is that you're using your entire leg. But so basically what it is it's riding inside on a stationary bike in a class that's set to music and led by a teacher.
Elizabeth, you sold real estate in Colorado when you were living there.
I was. I had grown up in a real estate family. My mother was a very successful real estate broker in Chicago, and ended up moving to Telluride. And while I was there, I got introduced to an arm of Oriental medicine called Jinshin Jitsu. So because of the lifestyle that exists in Colorado, I was able to do both, but just wasn't really the money that I would need to sort of live my life.
So you moved to New York City and you discovered indoor cycling. At what point did you say, you know what, this would be an interesting business to start?
You know, my sister-in-law owns Bikram Yoga, is a co-owner of Bikram Yoga here in the city. And so she was, I said to her, you know, I'm feeling this urge to do this. I mean, I had a five-month-old and a three-year-old. And she was really encouraging.
And how about you, Julie? You were a talent manager in Los Angeles.
I was in L.A. for about 9 years. And not unlike Elizabeth, I sort of had, you know, an aha moment on a bike. I've always been sort of athletic, but it's never really had a joyful effect on me before. I thought to myself, I get it. I understand why this can be something that's not just, you know, checking off, you know, exercise today on my to-do list.
What's an example of the impact that SoulCycle has had, not necessarily just physically?
Our experience now over and over again is people coming up to us and saying, you know, I don't go to my therapist anymore because I do it on the bike. Or I literally walked into the Upper East Side studio the other day and a woman came up to me and she said, I want you to know that you saved my life. She said, I just had a baby and I started working out here right after, you know, my child was born and you really saved my life. And I said to her, I'm so glad to hear it. You look amazing. How, you know, how old is your child? And she said, oh, my baby is 5 months old, but that's not at all what I'm talking about. She explained that it really helped her connect to her child and back to herself and to her family. For us, the surprise gift in this business has been the emotional release that it has given to people.
When you noticed the benefits of doing a spin class, why did you necessarily say, I'd like to start a business? Where did that come from?
Truth be told, I sort of looked high and low for an experience that would make me feel like what I had found in my, you know, little indoor cycling studio in Los Angeles. I tried every indoor cycling class in New York City, and I just could not find it.
Was there also some unhappiness with your current work environment that kind of gave you the extra push to say, you know what, I'd like something new?
Definitely. Well, one thing that Elizabeth and I have very much in common were we both started the business when we had babies that were 5 months old. After I had my daughter, I definitely was feeling like I would like to figure out a job where I could work on my own terms.
So you both had this idea in isolation. How did you ultimately meet each other?
We met at a lunch. We were introduced and we started to talk.
By a mutual friend.
Yes. And slowly but surely, we started to talk about the ideas that we had for creating an indoor cycling business. I like this about this place, but I think this could be better. Or wouldn't it be great if you could do some upper body work in the 45 minutes? Or could you imagine if
we had a reservation system?
Right. Or it was a, you know, a chic environment. Mm-hmm. Or all the teachers spoke the same language, so you didn't go to, you know, Joe's class at 10 in the morning and it was boot camp, and,
right,
you know, Bill's class at 10 o'clock in the evening and it was, you know, Zen cycle. We always say it was the best blind date we ever went on.
Have you looked at some studies that show the benefits of group exercise versus exercising on your own, for example?
If you drew a chart, you would probably see that the workout for a group of people is more consistent than one person working out by themselves. If you are out there on the West Side Highway running by yourself, on a low day you might run a little slower, and on a fast day you might run a little faster, but probably you are working at a pretty hard level if you are in a class at SoulCycle, because the group is going to carry you with them.
Incidentally, indoor cycling classes take place in the dark. Where did that come from?
For us, we do ride in candlelight, and it sort of sets the tone of a respectful room, a place where people you know, are there for the right reasons. We have this site on our page on our site called Soul Etiquette, which is just about, you know, how we treat each other. I mean, we really treat it as a sanctuary.
I noticed the music plays such a prominent role. Can you talk to a little bit about the music and really, you know, there's a DJ component to it.
Absolutely. Our Our instructors spend a lot of time creating their playlists. You know, there's a musical arc that follows the emotional arc, that follows the physical arc.
We have a place on the site where we put our 10 favorite songs of the month. We went through a real phase, and I think it's a classic. We'll always love the Alicia Keys and Empire State of Mind.
Alicia Keys and Jay-Z. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a group of indoor cycling studios in New York City, the Hamptons, and Los Angeles. So I want to switch to the nuts and bolts of how you started your business. So you had this excellent first date where you said, okay, I want to get started. So what were the first steps that you took?
Elizabeth started looking for spaces.
We were combing Manhattan. We weren't coming up with much. I mean, people don't really want to rent to, especially at that time in 2006, to people who have no track record whatsoever. So we managed to find a sublet in the back of a lobby on 72nd Street, great located, very well located on Craigslist. And we thought there was going to be a sign. And then just as we went to go sign the lease, they said, oh, I'm very sorry, but you don't have a sign and you're never going to have one. Mm. And if you would like to have one, it will be inside the lobby on your door. So we did a lot of guerrilla marketing. We got a rickshaw, which we painted. We painted it silver and yellow, which are two colors that we use. And we parked it out in front of the studio and locked it up, hoping that it wouldn't get stolen or ticketed. And we'd say, oh, should we spend another $65 on the ticket for this night so that people know where we are?
Well, we literally used to get a ticket every day from the community board for parking our rickshaw outside. And we parked out there for a long time until finally
stolen.
The community board wanted to actually see us.
Right. And then it got stolen. It was sort of a happy accident.
And how long did it take you from your first meeting to opening the doors on the first day?
4 months.
Yeah.
Quick.
Quick. After our first meeting, Elizabeth started looking for space immediately. And, you know, we didn't even know each other very well. So I was still working at my full-time job. And we would sort of talk in the morning and make our separate to-do lists. And I would schedule my lunch break. So, you know, I was representing models at the time. And, you know, I would sort of be creating shampoo deals and stuff. And then during lunch, I would meet the towel guy downstairs. We really just sat down and made a list. Things you need for cycling. Water, bikes, shoes, a space. Elizabeth went to IKEA and created most of our first studio out of IKEA cabinetry. Our front desk and our original studio is from good old IKEA.
And Elizabeth, you were also an investor in the beverage company Izzy, which was ultimately sold to Pepsi. How did you come to be one of the early investors in Izzy?
My best friend from college and her husband, who I grew up down the street from, happened to get married, and they started this company after their first daughter was born. We had seen it in Colorado, and, you know, I said to my husband, I said, well, I think we should put some money in it, and I called Todd, and he said, I cannot take your money. I'm going to lose it. I really cannot do this. And I said, okay, I completely understand, but I'm an adult, and if you change your mind, let me know. And 2 days later, he called, and he said, we just got a huge order from Whole Foods. It's our first big order, and we have no money to fill the order, so we will be glad to take your check. And then it was really just a really amazing, happy coincidence. I mean, we had the money to do what we needed to do. Sort of, it was extremely timely. The business was pretty successful from the beginning, but it just took the pressure off us in terms of, you know, paying back investors.
So were you the sole investor initially for the company?
Yes, I was.
So tell me a little more about the logistics of getting the business off the ground. What are some other kind of surprises that, you know, didn't go the way that you had hoped initially?
We put a lot of time into developing an online reservation system. So we would open the reservation system noon on Mondays. The bikes would open for the week and you could just sign up for the classes that you wanted. And we got to a point in the business where things got, as we started to add classes to the studio, things got really busy. And so the system would crash at noon on Monday, which is like the last thing in the world that you want to happen because you make people so mad. We really had to work through the technology of that.
We didn't know a lot about soundproofing in the beginning. Or how close people live to a building that you're playing music in.
Did you get complaints from neighbors or?
Oh, neighbors, other tenants, landlords. It was one of those. And it was like we threw every expensive Band-Aid on the ceiling that we could.
Well, we had hired a contractor at the behest of our broker who said he knew about soundproofing because he did porn studios in Midtown. And so we thought, well, these people really know what they're doing. And when it came right down to it, that technology did not work at all. We were so horrified because we thought we were doing good.
I will say on a larger scale, you know, we really, when we created this business, we actually created a very atypical model, which I think for us was probably one of the biggest obstacles in the beginning. New York had not really yet adopted the concept of boutique fitness, meaning a pay-per-class model, a pay-per-class cardio model. It's one of those things where you pay your money, you know, on a monthly membership to a gym, and you can take spin class. And so it's always a throw-in, a gimme. So I would say that for the first, you know, 6 months, a year, I mean, it was just a barrage of phone calls all day where you'd pick up the phone and the person on the other end would say, "This is included in my membership. Why would I pay you for something that I already get for free?" They were sort of outraged, actually.
You should tell that story about your father.
Oh, well, I remember showing my dad the first studio, and he walked in and he looked around and he looked for the showers and he couldn't find them. And he came a couple months after we'd been open, and he looked at me and he said, "People really come here?" And I said, "Yeah, people really come here, and the people that come here really like it." And I could just see him looking at my mother. Desperately afraid that we were not going to be able to send our child to college. The real truth is that they're a room with bikes in them.
And you showed him.
Yeah. Sort of.
He's Dad. Impressed now. He is impressed. It's very sweet to see how proud he is of Julie.
Given that this was, to some extent, a lifestyle change for both of you, given that you both had five-month-olds, did you have ambition to open up more than one studio, or did kind of success just create the inertia to get you to expansion mode?
Well, in the beginning, we thought if we had one great studio, that was...
Or maybe three.
But. That was really... I mean, but we really, you know, we had a certain number of riders, and we thought, oh my goodness, if we could get 50 people here every day, this would just be it. Imagine the feeling of the first morning that, you know, we opened the door and there was a full class. I mean, I can vividly remember the feeling of the first person that did not get a bike in a class.
And when did that happen?
I mean, that was maybe three or 4 or 5 months in.
Was there a catalyst? Meaning, what were those turning points, either in people or press, that really helped escalate your success?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because when we first opened the studio, I lived across the street. My husband and my daughter and I lived in a tiny rent-controlled apartment that we were busting at the seams growing out of. But on Sundays, I would, you know, sort of, you know, feed Phoebe her bottle and then say, "Oops, got to go put the garbage out. Tomorrow morning, the garbage guys are coming," you know, or maybe they left the candles burning from the last class. I should go check. I mean, it was that kind of a hands-on. We did everything. And I remember that when our first articles would come out, I would say to Elizabeth, "The New York Times is coming out tomorrow. I'm going to get to the studio at 5 a.m. because I can imagine what the phone calls are going to be like," you know, "Beg my husband, can you watch the baby this morning?" And we would sit there. And maybe if we got one or two phone calls the whole day. I mean, it was no more or no less than any other day at SoulCycle in the beginning. We had a perfect storm sort of a little bit into our business, and this is kind of what it was. The viral marketing started to pick up, and people started to come.
And people really brought their friends. I mean, it was like that commercial, the hair commercial. And the,
you know,
80s.
I told a friend, and they told
two friends.
Friends,
and so on and so on and so on. And it really was like that.
Then a bunch of press did come out, and then we opened a studio in Bridgehampton. So many people go out to vacation out in the Hamptons in the summer, and we thought it would be a really great way to spread the word. And it was really that fall, after that summer, that our business really started to pop.
And any kind of one celebrity that happened to come in that caused kind of a wave effect?
It was Bill Clinton. We did a fundraiser when Hillary was running for president, and we decided to raise money for Hillary's campaign. And it was
through a rider.
It was through a rider. and she helped us to get President Clinton there.
He didn't ride.
He didn't ride, but he came and he spoke about
healthcare.
And then we did a ride with what we assumed were going to be would have been his favorite songs if he had actually rode the bike. You know what? It was a slow news day, and everyone came. There was nothing else going on in the world except that President Clinton was speaking at SoulCycle. And I remember, and this was great, we called a company that did billboards on Fifth Avenue. And we begged them to stay up all night and make a wrap for the front doors of SoulCycle because we had no sign. And we knew that news crews would be outside wanting to shoot President Clinton going in because nobody could get inside the event. And so we had them create a facade that covered the entire doors so that when you pulled it open, it was a big wheel. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, our logo made it all over the news. It was on Entertainment Tonight, and it was on the New York Times and the Daily News. And it was really a big, big thing for us.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
Nice to be here.
My guests have been Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.